funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the new normal for a U.S. economy in recession, and how does the outlook in Texas compare with other U.S. states? While the state's economy slid into recession later than much of the rest of the country, it is there now, and the concentration of finance, insurance, and real estate jobs here in North Texas put the area on shaky ground. So what kind of market can we expect for jobs, for homes, and for businesses in the coming months? And what can current economic information tell us about the shape and timetable of recovery? W. Charles Sawyer is here to talk about those questions. He is Hal Wright Professor in Latin American Economics at TCU. We've invited him on the program today as part of KERA's year-long economy project. Support for KERA comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Facing the Mortgage Crisis is part of CPB's Public Service Media Economic Response Initiative. Charlie, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
You've predicted a long and slow and weak recovery. What tells you that's likely?
Well, to start out, what I'm going to be saying pretty much most of the time is the consensus. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, I'm mostly in international economics, economic development. Macroeconomics is, for me, a really serious hobby, sort of like baseball. And so The consensus is that given where we started a couple of years ago, the way this has developed, this is quite likely to be something different than our previous recoveries, that given where the U.S. economy is right now, it's going to take time. This is not going to be a speedy, quote-unquote, V-shaped recovery, where the economy hits bottom, bounces out very quickly, and we're all okay in 18 months. It doesn't seem likely that this time around it's going to play out that way.
What's the difference between a V-shaped recovery and whether this is a U-shaped recovery or something that's sort of sloping? In terms of the long-term impact, I mean, I think we can all understand what happens if 18 months later everything is as it was. But what lingering effects are there if the recovery takes longer?
Well, the problem is historically, the sharper the recession, the quicker the bounce and the steeper the slope of the bounce, the faster we get out of this thing. This has been a pretty deep recession. So looking at past recessions, you would say, well, you know, we'll bounce back quickly. Well, likely that's not going to happen because the debt levels that we had going into this that have not been purged. And so we're probably looking at, if not a U-shaped recovery, somebody described it last week as sort of a square root sign backwards.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so we pull out of it not real strongly and then sort of hit a plateau, and we may be cruising at that plateau for a while. Mm-hmm. As the economy tries to dig itself out of the situation that unfortunately we found ourselves in.
We've seen the markets really come bounding back in the last 6 or 7 months. Are investors irrationally exuberant right now?
You can ask Alan Greenspan. Perhaps he can.
I don't know. People aren't listening so much to him anymore.
Yeah. Economists are kind of not likely to use the word irrational very often. In this case, stock prices are dependent on what's happening to corporate profits. Last year was so awful in terms of corporate profits that what they refer to on Wall Street as the comps, the comparable profits relative to last year, we've had a big bounce back in corporate profits. So it isn't totally irrational that there's been a big bounce back in stock prices. Now, anybody that knows what's going to happen after this bounce back, well, that's another story. Forecasting stock prices is a relatively perilous thing. But the comps going forward are going to get much tougher. So there's always, given that situation, the comps were terrible last year, corporate profits are up. Can profits go up like that again? We'll see. But I think you can see right now in the markets, there's watch CNBC in the morning and you'll see people on both sides of this issue. But it's not necessarily irrational that we had such a big run given the circumstances.
Shorthand for a lot of people who are not professional economists is that if the market's doing well, the economy must be doing well or must be on the way up. Is it a mistake to tie the performance of the stock market to anything else in the economy?
No. I mean, the state of the economy affects the stock market. But for any individual stock, investors are looking at past earnings, current earnings, and future earnings. And so for many, many firms right now, the current earnings look really good compared to last year's earnings. Okay. And the market is just a collection of individual investors' decisions about individual stocks. Okay. So collectively, it's not real surprising that we've kind of had this run. I think the question is, can we sustain it? That's really something somebody else could probably comment on better than me.
How do we need to assess the effectiveness or lack of effectiveness of the stimulus and of the bailouts?
The bailouts, let's say it's too early to tell.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we got two bailouts going here. We've got the automobile industry. That, of course, is a lot more controversial. Time will tell whether or not those worked in some sense. We get 2 to 3 years out when we get a better sense of why that was done, why it was necessary. It's still a little too early, you know, to make definitive opinions about the automobile industry. The banking and the financial sector, now that's a different thing. Okay, before we went on the air, we were chatting about the Great Depression. The Federal Reserve will freely admit when the stock market crashed in 1929, that crash morphed over into the banking sector. Eventually, 25% of the banks in the country failed. And the Federal Reserve took a position that you hear commonly out in the street these days. These people have been irresponsible. Tech with them, let them fail. That was precisely the attitude of the Federal Reserve about 1930. Okay. And unfortunately, the crash in the financial sector took the economy down with it. One of the things you sign up for if you sign up to be a central banker is to save financial institutions that you know for a fact have been irresponsible.
It's like bailing out your kids.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It just goes with a job. If you're not willing to hold your nose and do that, then you should perhaps find another line of work. So the bailouts, while they were distasteful, perhaps, were absolutely necessary. It's a little too early to call victory. Everything is okay. We hope so. But as the nervousness this week over the default in Dubai has shown, there's still a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt out there. We hope we're out of the woods, but nobody can guarantee that. However, we are in much, much better shape. Think back where we were a year ago.
The federal budget deficit right now is something like 10 cents on the dollar of our GDP. How long can we sustain that?
As long as people are willing to loan us money. Okay. A good example on that is Japan. Japan has been running perpetual budget deficits for really the last 20 years. The national debt in Japan is now up to around 180% of GDP. I mean,
wow.
That's far, far more than what we're dealing with. The investment community is nervous. I mean, the rating agencies are asking tough questions. They have a new government there. We'd like to see some kind of plan that this is not going to go up indefinitely. Nobody knows. There's always a tipping point when a country becomes indebted, and it's hard to put an exact number on it. When your national debt gets up around 100% of GDP, which we're not there yet, there's going to be some nervousness out there among the people loaning you money. What I think is going to be necessary is when it becomes clear next year, perhaps the year after, that the recovery is in fact sustainable, that this is not going to go away. It's not fragile. At that point, it's going to become important for the government to come up with a credible plan, not to reduce the deficit immediately, but to get it on sort of a downward trajectory. And then at that point, everybody would be a lot more comfortable.
Can we look at the lack of more problems and a growth in the crisis as success in terms of the initial stimulus efforts, or is that letting ourselves and our government off too easily?
That's an interesting question. Some of our economic statistics are now turned positive. We still have many of them that are negative. They're just not as negative as they were 6 months ago. So there's two things about the stimulus package. One is its size. So there was some debate about that January and February among professional economists. Probably the thinking, there were many people arguing that it should have been larger. I think $750 billion, somewhere in that range, there was, most people are pretty comfortable with that. You're sort of quibbling when you get, should it be a trillion or $750 billion? The difficulty with the stimulus package is there's a trade-off here. We could have gotten more stimulus this year if we'd just gone out and thrown money at people. Here's checks, go spend it. On the other side, what do you have at the end of the day? You know, you hope that you have increased economic activity, but you're not sure. The way it was structured was a lot more towards infrastructure spending. And there was a lot of brave talk in Washington about shovel ready. It's very difficult to spend government money quickly. And most of the time, that's appropriate, as it should be. You want to be careful. What this means, though, is most of the stimulus money is going to get spent next year. So what recovery we've had has been really probably more linked to easy monetary policy, linked to what we call in economics the automatic stabilizers. When GDP goes down, people pay fewer taxes, frees up more money for their spending. You have automatic social spending that goes up, unemployment compensation, food stamps, et cetera. That's probably been our major cushion this year as opposed to pure stimulus spending, and that's normal. So one of the sources of optimism for next year is a lot of that stimulus spending is going to start kicking in, which is giving us pretty good growth forecast for next year considering the situation. Notice now we're already talking about stimulus too. Mm-hmm. You know, will that be enough, last long enough, to get us into a sustained recovery? We're not sure yet.
Well, and then there's a question of how you decouple the government from this level of support.
That, since it's infrastructure spending, that'll be fairly easy.
Just don't fund new projects.
That'll just die off on its own. Mm-hmm. And I would not be surprised at all if we get stimulus 2, say it's smaller, $400 or $500 billion. If the economy still appears weak, we might get another one. It just doesn't have to be as big. And given the government finances, we can probably do this a couple of more years, probably. But the government's going to have to keep analyzing this on an ongoing basis.
Do you think the money in stimulus 2 would go back in primarily to infrastructure spending?
That's a political decision.
Mm-hmm.
That's a political decision.
Does this become less politically viable as the years wear on?
I don't know. I bailed out of political science a long time ago. I mean, these are, you know, there's political economy where economics drifts into politics. Mm-hmm. And most economists sort of shy away, me included, from those kind of questions. Washington is an unpredictable place. But they do listen to advice. Okay, we have a Council of Economic Advisors to the President. People listen to Christina Romer. They, of course, listen to the people at the Federal Reserve. And there's a whole cottage industry of economists out there that are forecasting economic activity. And so it's not for lack of information about what the best minds think is going to occur.
Charlie Sawyer is my guest. He is Hal Wright, professor in Latin American economics at TCU. We will resume our recession outlook after this, and you're welcome to join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Announcing a new 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is TCU Professor of Economics Charlie Sawyer. We're talking about the recession and the outlook for Texas and the rest of the country and the rest of the world. You can find special resources and reports on the state of the economy at kera.org/economy. If you want to be part of the conversation this afternoon, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Charlie, I want to talk a little bit about Texas. We were slower into the recession by at least a couple of quarters, but now we're here. What does that delay in entering the recession say, potentially, about our ability to pull ourselves out of it?
Well, I mean, Texas for the last 30 years almost has been perhaps the healthiest economy of all the states in the United States. So it's fairly typical when you have a fast growth economy like Texas, it's well diversified, things are going extremely well. We don't have quite the housing problems that many, we're not Florida.
Land is cheap.
Exactly. Land is still cheap. Perhaps the lenders here learned a lesson in the late 80s, early 90s that still lingers. We had our own housing crisis before, but for a number of reasons, we were relatively late going into the recession, which is pretty typical. Hopefully, we'll be one of those states that comes out more quickly. But if the recovery turns out to be rather muted, which is what most people are expecting, then even a fast growth state may not experience, we may well get out of this a little quicker, but it's not something you could take to the bank. Now, if I could just do a small divergence here, there's a problem when we start talking about the Texas economy. We gather economic statistics on a national basis. The state and local statistics come down to us with anywhere from a 1 month to a 12-month lag. So one of the really frustrating things, if you're an economist, is you can find out all of this wonderful information about the economy of the country. And it's kind of like, well, what about Texas? Well, give us 6 months. Okay. So, for instance, before I came in today, I was trying to find the latest unemployment statistics for the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Well, the statistics for October will be out late this week. It's very, very frustrating. And it really hinders people's ability. You have to forecast based on where you are. We don't know where we are in Texas. We don't know what the total output of the state has, what's happened to that since the recession started. So it becomes very difficult to start prognosticating when you don't have information that you have for the country. It's very frustrating. And so I think you'll find typically economists, they get very reticent about what about the state? What about the local area? We don't have the information that we have for the country.
So much of our economy in this state is tied to the fact that we are located on the border with Mexico. What kinds of changes have we seen now that there is less, there are fewer jobs by any measure, even in Texas, presumably fewer remittances going back across the border?
Yes. I mean, there's no joke about Canada, but it really applies to Mexico. When the Canadian, when the American economy catches cold, the Canadian economy catches pneumonia. For Mexico, you can just about double that. Mexican GDP this year will probably drop twice as fast as the GDP in the United States. Of course, we don't have precise numbers on the number of migrants that have gone home, but it's very clear migrants have started returning home. Remittances are down enormously. I was reading something last week I hadn't thought of. There are reverse remittances now. Relatives sending money back to relatives in the United States that are in distress because they have lost their jobs.
That's pretty much unprecedented.
It's almost unprecedented. In effect, sadly, we're exporting unemployment back to Mexico, Central America, and other foreign countries. Latin America as a whole is weathering this storm quite well, but Mexico is so tied to the U.S. economy that there's just no way they can escape this.
Has that reverse migration been a factor in protecting us from the double-digit unemployment that we've seen in other U.S. states?
since we don't have a precise count on the number of illegal workers in the United States, that's hard to say. But as we like to say in the economics, the direction of change is clear. With these people going back, it's muting the impact of unemployment. To exactly what degree, that's difficult to say.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is TCU Professor of Latin American Economics, Charlie Sawyer. Let's speak to Kyle in Irving. Hi, Kyle.
Hello. Hi. I've been unemployed for a couple of years, so I've had a lot of time to research and study the economy. And one pattern that I'm seeing is some sort of a bubble, or I would call it the next big thing, that seems to bring us out of the recessions. For instance, in the 80s, maybe it was real estate and tax cuts. The 90s, perhaps information technology. The new millennium, perhaps loosening of credit standards. And I'm kind of wondering what's the next big thing? What's going to bring us out of this? Is it renewable energy, or what is it, if anything?
Thanks for your call, and good luck finding a job.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's that's always hard to determine, because the people that can actually see that coming tend to get rich and retire. So it's very, very difficult to put your finger on these. So let's think about the parts of the economy. Consumption by the public, which is about 70% of GDP, is likely to be weak for quite some time. So it's difficult, unless you can find a very narrow niche in that consumption, to see anything going on there. Same thing with investment in housing. It's a little bit hard to see the next big thing. If I wanted to look at the broader picture of things, if there's a place where there's some cautious optimism about the U.S. economy, it's in exports. We have a weak dollar. That's, as long as our interest rates are low, that's likely to be quite low for a good while. U.S. industry at the right exchange rate is still extremely competitive in world markets. We're still a major exporter of commodities. And so if you're looking for a place where the U.S. economy could potentially do quite well over the next 3 to 5 years in terms of rebalancing our economy, there's some faith on the export side.
Do we have sufficient manufacturing capacity to make that possible? Or are you talking about agricultural product?
Definitely. We have sufficient manufacturing capacity to dramatically increase exports. There's a little bit of a pattern here. Manufacturing peaked about 50 years ago at about a third of the economy. It's now down to about 20%. That apparently is pretty much bottomed. I mean, nothing goes down forever. And so it really looks like manufacturing as a percentage of GDP. We've got less low-end manufacturing, but what many of us don't see is the extremely expensive products that American industry now produces. And, of course, the labor movement is under stress because manufacturing employment as a percentage of total employment continues to decline. We're producing the same amount of manufacturing output with far fewer workers than we did 40 or 50 years ago.
Based on technology?
Based on technology and capital investment. Mm-hmm. And so nobody really knows where the bottom of that employment figure is. But it's starting to look like manufacturing may stabilize at somewhere around 20% of GDP. And you go around the world, in many years, the United States is still the world's largest exporter.
An email here from Tim in Dallas asks if you would comment on China's current monetary policy and how our monetary policy interacts with China's.
Oh, that's a very good question. There's a lot of debate on that right now. The Federal Reserve has flooded the financial system with money. That money is showing up as excess reserves in the banking system. And so you're starting to see what some people call speculative bubbles in commodities, and perhaps some of that money is drifting over into the Chinese economy and creating bubbles over there. The thing you have to understand about China, though, is China has exchange controls. Capital flowing does not flow freely into and out of the country. The central bank still controls that. So while it perhaps is possible that excess liquidity in the U.S. economy that we don't have any use for right now is flowing into other economies where they have free flows of capital, that argument that this is causing speculative bubbles in China is that perhaps so, because there's money that comes into China backdoor from Hong Kong, of course, but that's yet to be proven. I'm not going to say that can't happen, but I would sure like to see a little more proof.
The Chinese economy is still growing so rapidly as compared with much of the rest of the world. Is there, though, a point at which the whip finally cracks over the border of China?
That's under the best of circumstances. As a country gets richer, growth tends to naturally slow down. Okay, 20, 25 years ago, South Korea was growing like China. They now grow at a somewhat slower rate. China will get there. Okay, growth will inevitably slow. So there are some, of course, doom mongers on China. You know, it's all a bubble, and Chinese economic statistics are a little, perhaps not as well formed as they are in some other countries. There is always a little suspicion.
So they're massaged, is what you're saying? Or
there's always that, I wouldn't say charge, but there's a little bit more jaundiced eye thrown at Chinese economic statistics than normal. So, but trends matter. I mean, you can't massage statistics forever. And so the Chinese economy is doing well this year. They have a massive stimulus package, though. And they can keep it up for a while. They have a lot of money in the bank. But once that stimulus gets withdrawn, then I think you're going to have a little better picture of what's going to happen to the Chinese economy going forward. And, I mean, it's a large hole in their exports. The global economy is still weak. It's not projected to bounce back strongly anytime soon. It's been a very export-oriented economy. So once the stimulus starts being withdrawn, then I think we'll all have a lot better picture of what the Chinese economy is going to look like going forward.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here that asks, is enough attention being placed on regulation of the banking and financial industries to prevent another meltdown?
Very good question. First thing is sort of a general principle. Modern capitalism was born about 500 years ago, and we have had financial crisis that's after financial crisis. That's just something you live with to get the benefits of capitalism, unfortunately. It's also an unfortunate reality that markets can always move faster than regulations. Always. So we're in an interesting period right now. We have done well. There's a tendency when a crisis hits to overreact, to do something too quickly. We haven't done that. And so I think one of the things that the regulators are struggling with is to try to get a system. We're going to have to move past the traditional regulation of banks and start regulating what we used to call in the old days non-bank banks. That's a phrase. Or we now call the shadow banking system. Mm-hmm. We have financial institutions out there that are what we call performing intermediation. They're moving money from savers to investors, which is a lot of what banks do. It's not everything a bank does, but a lot of what banks do. And we have to figure out how to widen that umbrella to include institutions other than banks without strangling the innovations that these people come up with. Sometimes those innovations blow up in our faces. But for instance, the current crisis, a lot of it is tied to securitization. This bundling up of loans together and selling them out in a larger market, that's going to survive. It's a good idea. Some of us are old enough, we can remember the blow up in the jump bond market in the late 80s, early 90s. Jump bonds are there, well and healthy. They're a good part of our financial system. We're going to have to figure out a way to keep securitization, to keep non-bank banks still involved in financial intermediation, but in a careful way. And that's, I couldn't say anybody at this point, I don't think anybody has come up with a plan that goes, oh, that's it. Yeah, that's exactly how we need to do this. And so this may take a while before we come up with a set of regulations that the industry is comfortable with, that the government is comfortable with, that the public is comfortable with, and perhaps we just aren't far enough past the crisis to do that yet.
Aside from increasing regulation or even just amending regulation, do we need to look at any kind of fundamental restructuring of the way we run our economy?
I don't think anybody's looking at a fundamental restructuring. Although the financial services industry, we had a bubble not only in housing, but in the financial services industry in general. And so there's going to be restructuring. If we got to the point at the peak where 75% of our economy was consumption by the public and housing, that's a monster number.
Because that's tied to a lot of debt.
It's tied to a lot of debt. Mm-hmm. And the restructuring that's going to have to occur, and this is going to take a long time. If you go back 30 years or so, you're looking at consumption by the public was 2/3 of GDP. Housing is normally, at the peak, housing was 6% of GDP. It's normally 4. So we've got 5 to 10% of GDP that's going to have to be reallocated out of consumption and housing, probably into investment and exports. And, of course, some of it will probably go into government spending. So those kind of changes, I mean, you know, in one sense, 5% of GDP, 8% of GDP doesn't sound like very much, but it's a lot. And that's not – the restructuring is mostly a natural restructuring that's going to occur in the private sector. It's inevitable.
Charlie Sawyer is my guest. He's Hal Wright Professor in Latin American Economics at TCU. We are talking about the outlook for the recession and the potential recovery. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a new 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Support for KERA comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Facing the mortgage crisis is part of CPB's Public Service Media Economic Response Initiative, and that is why we're having today's conversation about the recession with W. Charles Sawyer, who is Hal Wright Professor in Latin American Economics at TCU. If you want to be part of the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Charlie, how do we get the banks to loosen up and start lending money?
They're already lending money. That's kind of a small bright spot here. I was reading the other day that loan volume is about 80% of what it was pre-crisis. Now, that's...
Is that maybe where it should have been all along?
Perhaps. The other side of that, of course, is we're down 20%. Mm-hmm. So the banks have, you know, perhaps one of the problems the banks ran into is, you know, instead of doing the old due diligence where you had to know a banker to own money and to loan money and to borrow money, and banks check individual clients very carefully, you know, people got over perhaps relying on FICO scores and credit ratings, and, well, that didn't end well. So now you're a banker, you're not really used to doing it the old way. You don't trust the credit scores anymore. This makes you awfully cautious. And I think that the biggest problem with bank lending right now is lending to small business. Small businesses are very vulnerable in this downturn. In many cases, their finances are quite precarious. And so you start talking to small business people, and you're hearing story after story of, I had a credit line with the bank, and it's gone.
And this is people who have paid and not been in default.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. But the banks have gotten so nervous about this type of lending. That, I think, is going to be a problem. It's already cropped up. One of my greatest fears for next year is that this is a problem that is going to be difficult to address. It's easy for the government, or not as hard for the government, to loan money to General Motors. It's a little harder for somebody to loan money to a landscape company.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's one of the hardest things that's happening right now in the financial services industry, is that relationship. Banks are frightened, but unfortunately they're cutting back to some of the most vulnerable customers. What that's going to mean in the first couple of quarters next year, that right now is one of my major concerns.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll speak next with Raul in Dallas. Hi, Raul.
Hi. I have a question. It's a two-part question. What do you think about the Chilean economy? And do you have to know that in Chile they have presidential elections on the 13th of December? And there's a big chance that right-wing government will come in. Do you happen to see that the economy in Chile will change? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
That is a great question. For the last 20 years, Chile has been kind of the benchmark economy of Latin America. They've done better than anybody else. However, in the last 10 years or so, with success, growth has slowed a little bit. They're no longer growing at the 5 to 6% rate they were. It's now more like 3.5%. There's, I think, in the country, a little bit of a feeling of something lost, that it's not quite as dynamic as it once was. And politically, though, in Latin America, Concertación has been running the country for 20 years. And perhaps there's a feeling that there's a little loss of momentum when a party has been in power for so long. The right-of-center coalition has a very popular, dynamic candidate, somebody perhaps that you could compare to Vicente Fox in Mexico a few years ago. And it looks like they're set to win the election. But the nice thing about Chile is that there's general agreement on the broad outlines of economic policy. And so what needs to be worked on is, in much of Latin America, is great dissatisfaction with the education system. And going forward into the 21st century, a country that's going to be fast growth in the 21st century has got to have world-class education. And I think in the country there's great dissatisfaction with that. The infrastructure, of course, needs to be improved. With growth has come perhaps some increase in income inequality. So to me, there's a little... Chile is not doing quite as well as they were 10 years ago, but let's be realistic. I mean, most countries in the world would easily trade Chile's problems for theirs problems. And to me, this is just a really good example of democracy in Latin America. People are talking about real issues. It's not so much about personalities. They're talking about education, infrastructure, economic growth. Occasionally, I look south and some of the debates you see, and I wish we could get a little bit of that up north.
How concerned are you about deflation right now?
Deflation is a concern. There's two issues here. One is the Japanese economy has been battling deflation for 20 years, and they're about to slip back in it. Now, let's not go too far with that comparison. I mean, what happened to Japan in the late 80s and early 90s was far, far more severe than anything we're going through. As an example, their major stock exchange peaked at 38,000 and bottomed at 5,000. 20 years later, it's barely over 10. That's kind of an index for what's happened to the country. The Bank of Japan moved far more slowly in dealing with the crisis than the Federal Reserve did. And so that's one of the reasons the Federal Reserve was in such a hurry, for fear of that. And once deflation sets in, that's a really bad thing. That this is not something, inflation is not a good thing, but deflation, it's very hard to get an economy going again once a deflationary psychology has set in.
Because people are afraid to invest anything.
They're afraid to invest, but it's like, why buy today? It'll be cheaper tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, imagine if the mindset all of us have when we buy a computer applied to everything. It just slows down spending. And you start feeling foolish spending money because it'll be cheaper. Now, that said, there's a technical problem here that people need to be aware of. The inflation statistics, the government does not use housing prices directly. They use rental equivalents. So the decline in housing prices has not hit the indexes yet. Now, housing, buying a house and renting a house are substitutes. There's going to be a point where rents are probably going to fall. It's 25% of the index. So there's probably some downward price pressure baked in. So nobody would be terribly surprised if we perhaps saw maybe a little deflation next year. But the Federal Reserve is scared to death of it and is going to work to try to remedy that problem. And we got an offsetting force here with a dollar so low, import prices are rising rapidly. So since the inflation number is kind of an overall number, if we get lucky, we'll escape that. Given how aggressive the Federal Reserve has been, I wouldn't be terribly worried about deflation. However, I can't sit here and say, oh, no, that can't happen. It's just absolutely not a possibility. It's way too early to make that kind of statement. Bears watching.
With all of the bubbles that we've dealt with and seen shattered, what do economists do to find the true value of any sector of the economy or of any particular good or service?
Well, you have to get down in sort of the guts of the price indexes, mm-hmm. because the price indexes are overall averages. But you'll find places in there, there's lots of detail. Automobiles, housing, you can go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics and just take 5 minutes to look at it. It's incredible the level of detail. And so when you're talking about value, we think of that in terms of real prices, mm-hmm. prices adjusted for inflation. So when you see something and the real price is going up, that price is going up faster than inflation, that's something that's becoming more valuable. And when those real prices are falling, that's a signal to the market that this is becoming less valuable and that we need less of it. Housing being a perfect example.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the housing prices in Texas are pretty much immune from the kinds of drops? Obviously, we haven't seen the fall in value that we've seen elsewhere, but there comes a point at which the houses are more difficult to sell even here.
Sure. And that's one of the problems with being such a large state. I mean, you can get metro area housing data, and you're seeing a lot of divergence. You're seeing, you know, neighborhoods in Houston or Dallas or El Paso where prices are falling, not as much as they're falling nationally. You may see there's some difficulties at the high end because of mortgage financing, you know, for anything over $400,000+. The overall numbers for Texas don't look too bad, but within that overall average in such a large state, it's hiding a lot of variation. So this is, you know, I hate to be trite, but all real estate is local. Mm-hmm. People, you know, in thinking about buying a house and making real estate decisions, need to be extra cautious about what's going on because there are probably markets where prices, you know, haven't hit bottom yet. They're probably already neighborhoods where prices may have ticked up some. It's a very, you know, you've had people in here talk about real estate. It's a little too early to say, oh, yes, this is the bottom. Everything is wonderful. This is probably a time almost anywhere in the country, and perhaps particularly in Texas because we started late, to be cautious.
Earlier in the hour, we had the caller who mentioned that he's been looking for work for a couple of years. And I want to talk about the difference economically between short-term unemployment for 3 months or 6 months and long-term unemployment.
Yes. We really categorize unemployment three ways. I mean, even in a very healthy economy, we've got something called frictional unemployment. People moving between jobs. It's normal. It's perfectly healthy. An old joke in economics, an unemployment rate of zero would be a really scary thing. Cuba's got it. North Korea's got it. But that's not – some level of unemployment is normal. What we're going through now is what we call cyclical unemployment. People are losing their jobs because the economy stinks. When the economy comes back, some of these jobs will come back. But there's a third category of unemployment that we call structural unemployment. as the structure of the economy changes, people lose their jobs and these jobs aren't coming back. Now, in the long view of things, structural unemployment is a good thing because you don't want too many workers tied up in declining industries. You want to free these people up to go to industries where the prospects are better. That's awfully tough to do when the economy is not doing well. And it's a further problem in that industries tend to be regional. So you can see what's happening in Detroit. There's no place for these unemployed workers to go within that local area. So a troubling thing that is coming up, one of the things that's always been a great strength of the U.S. economy, is those structurally unemployed workers, or it shows up in the data as long-term unemployed, like our caller. Those have always been a minority, relatively small minority of the total unemployed, maybe 10 or 15%. We're now up at 25% and rising.
Of those unemployed, are long-term unemployed?
Are long-term unemployed now. Mm-hmm. Now, we're uncertain right now how much of that is attributable to the prolonged nature of this recession and how much of that is going to be relatively sticky even when the economy starts pulling out of this. But it's a very worrisome thing. We've been able to observe this in Europe for a long time because Europe has always been the reverse. Most of their unemployed are long-term unemployed. We've never really had to deal very much with that. And I think going forward in the next year or two, this is where the government is perhaps has a role to try to design programs to help these kind of workers, like our caller, get new skills, retrain, perhaps pay for relocation expenses, to try to reduce that problem. It's going to be, I think, since we haven't had to deal with it much in the United States, it's going to require some creativity and probably some changes in our programs and our ways of thinking about unemployment.
Is there a declining utility to those programs for, say, workers over 50 who have done the same thing for 30 years?
There's always a problem with long-term unemployment, with workers that lose their job over the age of 50.
Mm-hmm.
In many cases, what happens with these workers that isn't getting the statistics very well is, yes, they go back to work, but they were making $18 an hour, and now they're making $11.
Yeah, so it's not the same.
They have a job,
lifestyle.
But it's not quite the same job. And that's where, even for older workers now, somebody 50 years old, you know, may have another 20 productive years. And so 18 months at a technical training school may well pay for itself, even for an older worker.
W. Charles Sawyer is Hal Wright Professor in Latin American Economics at TCU. You can find special resources and reports on the state of the economy at kera.org/economy. Charlie, it's been a great hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you so much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.